All right. Well, I thought today we would talk about Korea, and I made this decision that I would talk about Korea before the news came out, as Korea has definitely been in the news the last week. I hope that as we go forward that my classes are not quite so topical as to what's happening, because that probably will not be a good sign for whatever country or area that we talk about. In the next couple weeks, I hope to make use of the resources that we have in this room and maybe get insight from, talk maybe about Papua New Guinea with Yvonne as her background, and then maybe Argentina the week following, and just some of the missions there. So great to make use of resources of those who know far more than I do. Why Korea? And no, as I mentioned, we aren't talking about them because of the ICBMs, but Korea is an interesting place to talk about in the missions movement, because a lot of missiologists oftentimes are looking at Korea as what happened there? What happened in Korea? Why did the gospel go forth in such powerful ways? And what can we do to replicate that in the future? The Korean church has been a powerful church in the over the century since its foundation, and it is now a sending church. South Korea had the goal of sending out 10,000 missionaries by 2000, and by 2010 there were 20,000 missionaries that were sent out. So it is a powerful sending country. It's not perfect by any means, but it has been used, and it has continued to be used for the gospel. And in speaking about it and going into the story of Korea, the verse I chose here was Titus 1:5, of "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you." And I think as we go in and we start studying, you're going to see some of just the emphasis and the training that was done in establishing faithful men and women to go forward and to build up the local church within Korea. So here's my exposure to Korea is Amy and I one time had a 24-hour layover in Seoul, and so we tried to do as much as we possibly could. This is a royal palace in downtown Seoul, and we stayed overnight at a bathhouse, and we just tried to do it up and get the full experience. So there's a photo of that. And so here is why Korea transitioned from an unreached people to a sending country. There's lessons to be learned from the church, and then the persecution particularly that goes on in North Korea today. Okay. I found this quote. It's a Korean quote. It's, "When the whales fight, the shrimp's back is broken." And that's sort of a quote of the Korean history. As you're probably aware, Korea is that little peninsula far off on the easternmost part of Asia. And it has generally been sort of the Ireland of Asia. Okay, it's small, it's geographically isolated, it's been dominated by foreign powers, much like Ireland's been dominated by England and then Britain. It has been dominated typically by China and by Japan. So historically, Korea was very much in China's orbit. The way the Chinese worked, they weren't like the Europeans, go in and conquer and colonize, but what they would do is they would have sort of a tribute relationship. So you would acknowledge that they were superior to you, and then they would provide gifts and things like that. And Korea was very much sort of a tribute state in that sense. It was relatively independent, but still, it acknowledged China's superiority, and from that relationship came a lot of the Confucianism and the Buddhism that influenced the Korean background and history, and so that's sort of where it started. Now, in around the 1850s, that was when the U.S. went into Japan. Okay, and Japan had been closed off to the rest of the world, And Commodore Perry went in and opened Japan up by gunpoint. And in the aftermath of that, Japan started a very rapid modernization. And with that, they began then to dominate Korea. Okay, they came in and they invaded it, basically annexed it in the year 1910. And they repressed the culture, the language, and the national status of Korea. And there was actually a war between Japan and China during the late 1800s. It was interesting, the palace that we went and we saw in Seoul, the royal family of Korea were the Lees, L-E-E. But Japan wanted to repress the Koreans and remove their national identity. So what they did is they tried to argue that the ruling family of Koreans was the Lee from China, L-I. And so what they did is they put characters, the Chinese characters for the Lee family, all over the royal palace of Korea to basically assert that they were always under Chinese domination instead of Korean independence. So a very, very sort of subtle. You can imagine, think if you will, what would happen if we had the Abraham Lincoln Memorial in the U.S. You know, that would, just by changing the name, that would be a attack, I guess, on your history and your background. So they were very much repressed, and that's going to come in, and that's going to play an influence in the work of the and how the church goes forward. So some of this may easily be review. At the very end of World War II, you know, the Soviets had not been a part of the war against Japan, but then at the end they invaded Manchuria. That's a part of China just right above Korea. And Korea was then divided into a northern part that was dominated basically by the Soviets and was a client state of the USSR. And then the southern part was controlled by the U.S. and subsequently by a government established under that. The north at that time was a wealthier part. It was closer to Manchuria. Manchuria was a very heavy, the Japanese had done quite a lot to industrialize it while they controlled Manchuria. Northern Korea was that way. And we'll talk about this in a bit. Pyongyang was considered the Jerusalem of the East at that time. I think Billy Graham's wife, I think Ruth, is that right? I think she went to school. She went to school in Pyongyang. It was a very heavily, there was a great influence there of Christian influence there. So in 1950, we have the Korean War. North Korea invades South Korea, and the UN, with the U.S. in the lead, goes and joins in the war. And this was sort of a crazy war. I've heard it described as sort of a backyard brawl, because North Koreans invade, and they get almost all the way down to the very south of Korea, and so there's huge amount of refugees that are just fleeing south. And then there's the Incheon Landing, where the U.S. sends troops about halfway up the coast, and they just push forward, and they get almost to the Chinese border, and MacArthur is wanting to invade China at that time. And so that of course creates huge more amounts of refugees because the armies are moving so far forward north. And then the Chinese enter the war at that point, and they push back down. And so just a huge amount of death and turmoil and catastrophe that had resulted from this war before it eventually sort of got into a bit of a stalemate. And then there's never been peace in the Korean War. There's only been an armistice. So technically North and South Korea are still at war. But there, a line was drawn, and that's where we get the demilitarized zone, the DMZ, which is basically the border, for lack of a better term, though it's not really a border because it's because they're still technically at war between the two parties. And then, so as I mentioned a little bit before, North Korea was historically more economically advanced. And so it remained that way for a little bit of time, even after the war, because South Korea was so impacted by the Korean War. At the end of the war, the average salary of a South Korean was less than that of a Somalian. so something like $64 a year or something like that. From the 1980s on, though, South Korea has exploded economically while North Korea has imploded. It is one of the miracles of, when we talked about urbanization and economic development, Korea is I think now maybe about the 14th richest country in the world or something like that. It is very advanced. Probably there's a good chance that we either own a car or a phone or a television or something from Samsung or Hyundai or Kia or one of those things. It has really entered the world marketplace, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. But that's a lot of their, with that wealth has come those issues of urbanization and materialism that plague us and deal with us. Leader in technology, pop culture. This may be the only time that this song comes up in a Sunday school class. I would not recommend listening to it, but there's a song, Gangnam Style, which was the most popular song in history. It was the first song ever to have 1 billion downloads on YouTube. It's well over two. I think it's approaching 3 billion downloads now. So South Korea has a huge cachet, I guess, in world culture, sort of like U.S. goes somewhere and they're always talking about U.S. songs or movies or things like that. Korea has very much that sort of presence now, too. It is not only a leader in technology, but it is also a leader in pop culture. So, yeah, don't go out and listen to that as a part of this class, but it is out there. And so since that, the South Korea has really exploded economically while the North has stagnated. And here's a picture of Korea at night. So I think here's South. That would be Seoul right there, that huge cluster. I think it's approaching 20 million people. And there is Pyongyang, that little image of light. But other than that, the whole of North Korea is pretty much just in darkness. Koreans are historically, ethnically very homogenous, very, very pure in their genetically. And it's starting to change now, particularly as Korea has, as it, like other Asian countries, has had some issues with abortion and sex selection. And so now a lot of Korean men are marrying foreign women, having foreign brides. But historically, they're very pure. And so there's not a whole lot of genetic dissimilarities between North and South. But it's something like the average height difference between North Koreans and South Koreans is something like 5 or 6 inches because of malnourishment. It's just, and you take it out, every other factor is the same. So that is strictly what is part of their diet, and so that just shows you a little bit of the poverty that is and the difference between the two countries. So that's just a little overview, Korea in 10-15 minutes. But here, let's get into the history of Christianity in Korea. Historically, it was called the Hermit Kingdom. It's still sometimes called that. You may see that in the news when they talk about North Korea. I had thought, that's just referring to they're so isolated. Well, no, that is a historic term. They had been closed off to the outside world. And with that, there had been some Jesuit missions to Korea, but those had been pretty much shut off. And then there was this Robert Germain Thomas was one of the first missionaries to Korea. He had actually been a missionary sent to China, and his wife had died, and he had basically given up the mission work. He had a real facility for languages, but he was working in a clerk's office at the time. And he came across some couple of Korean believers. And so he began then to work to take the gospel into Korea. He learned the language. And in the 1860s, he went aboard an American ship that was seeking to open up the kingdom, and the ship that ended up running aground in a river, and they ended up having a battle between the two sides. The ship caught on fire, and he and the rest of the ship's party came onto land. And the story is that before he was executed, he handed a Bible to his to the man who was to execute him. And subsequently, several of those pages were pasted up on the wall in the man's house, and that became the church that they met. And so it was his blood and the blood of others that was sort of the start of the work. After that time, in the late 1800s, their missions did go forward in there. And there was a very heavy Presbyterian presence. And there was this missionary by the name of John Nevius. And I got to read his book this week. It was interesting. He was actually a missionary in China, and the Chinese had a lot of the Chinese missions. They had their mission station, and they would bring the believers in, and they would then live there. And he wrote a book basically critiquing Chinese missionary activity. One of the big problems was the fact that they would have rice Christians. There was always this idea that, well, these people had come to Christianity for the food, for the provisions of their needs. And he had he critiqued that work graciously. I mean, in this book, he's talking about mistakes that he's made in addition to others. But he wrote a book, and he had a very strong influence then on the Korean missionaries. So they pretty much took his principles. And so a lot of the, I guess, mistakes or methods that they desired to change from the work in China, they then had these principles change as they went forward in Korea. And it's a lot of people attribute this subsequent success of Korean missions and ministry to his book and those who were influenced by it. And so he had a lot of these principles as far as the prayer and buildup of the local leadership. And there was a real emphasis from the very beginning in the Korean church to turn the work over to the locals as quickly as possible and to make projects sustainable by the nationals and to avoid making rice Christians. So that was very much part of their effort right from the start. Okay. And out of that grew one of these events. It's called the 1907 Pyongyang Revival. And this is considered to be one of the great movements in church history worldwide. There had been some... These missionaries were studying. There had been a Welsh revival, and then there had been some revivals in India, and they began praying for several months and coming together and praying for that revival would sweep Korea. And in that year, it did. And just amazing stories of confessions, of public confessions of sin and prayer, and just powerful movement. And this was a period of great explosion within the church. People going up and praying, and then admitting to the fact that they had stolen from others and so forth. And I think sometimes we tend not to emphasize the power of public confession of prayer. Public confession of sin, but just the powerful impact it has. I noticed it once. A friend of mine and I, we were visiting a village in China, and we were staying at this house, and he decided to share the gospel with this couple. And he goes and he shares, and the man begins talking about one of his neighbors who had become a Christian, and he was powerfully moved by the fact that as soon as she became a Christian, she began going around to every house confessing the sins that she had done. And so he was telling about how she had come and confessed the theft of a chicken at some point. he didn't become a believer at that time, but it was just interesting to see, you know, this was 20 some years ago, just a powerful influence that this had, the confession of sin to these people. And in one area where there was where this was really emphasized is Korea was dominated by Japan at this time. There was a great deal of confession of the sin of racism. There was a great hatred of the Japanese at this period of time. They had been abusing them and treating them poorly. But the church went forward and repented of this sin of just bitterness to the Japanese, which by the world standards were totally normal and an appropriate response. But this forgiveness went forward and was used powerfully to bring the church forward. Koreans since that time and have been, while they're located there on the far corners of Asia, Koreans do have where their location is they're well located as far as, we oftentimes think of an ethnic people in where the borders end, and that is not the case with the Koreans by any means. Ethnic Koreans can be found in China and Russia and Korea. They have been used greatly within, ethnic Koreans have been used greatly within China to spread the gospel as well as Korea. And there was a great story in Let the Nations Be Glad by John Piper that several of the Koreans, after the Japanese had come in, went up to Vladivostok in Russia and were staying there. Well, that's a very important port. And Stalin didn't like the fact that all these Koreans were there. He thought it was a danger to him politically to have this many in such a strategic city. So they moved the Koreans all the way to Uzbekistan in the middle of Asia. And God used that to bring many of the Uzbeks, previously unreached people group, to Christ. So just amazing that God would be using even such a horrific dictator as Stalin for the advancement of his kingdom, and that he would use these people that refer to themselves as shrimps among whales to spread forth his gospel. Interestingly enough, sadly, the North Korean, the Communist Party, a lot of the early founders had come from Christian backgrounds, either come from Christian families and they rebelled against it. The ruling family, Kim Il-sung's, his family actually came from a Christian background. And if you ever read anything about North Korea, North Korean is not atheistic. North Korea essentially has a state religion, and it's called Juche, and it's basically self-reliance is what that means, but it is basically a celebration and a worship of the Kim royal, of the Kim family, and they use a lot of, it's sort of a perverted, some of the Christian principles and so forth in the use of that religion. Okay. So, let me go to that. So today, as far as South Korea, approximately 25 to 30% of the population of South Korea identify as Christians. And they are well known for their evangelistic fervor. I have a Subway story in parentheses. When Amy and I went to China, it's interesting, we're working at a university. And it's interesting, a lot of times the teachers at Chinese university are either believers or they're the most godless people opposed to the gospel that you could possibly imagine. It creates a little bit of a tension, obviously, within the foreigners that come from such different backgrounds. And we happened to be teaching with one of these men who was definitely bitterly opposed to the gospel. He was an Australian. And he told the story of being in a subway in Seoul one time on a visit and having four separate people come and share the gospel with him. And he was just outraged at the thought. And we're thinking, wow, this is great. I mean, this is just fantastic. And it was just such a powerful story of how they go forth. And the Korean church is known too for its devotion to prayer. Korean style prayer, they often all pray at the same time. When I was in the Philippines this spring, I was told a story of several South Korean ministers had come to the Philippines, and they were challenging the Filipinos of, you don't care about your country and the gospel as much as we care about your country and the gospel. And of course, the Filipinos are sort of taken aback by that. And several of the South Koreans took the Filipinos to South Korea, and they had this mountain where, and they basically sent them and said, go and pray for your country. And the Filipinos prayed for a few minutes, and they came back, and they were told, no, you need to go back, pray for your country. And they did so for hours. I'm not offering one way or another, but you get the idea of there's just this passionate devotion for prayer that the South Koreans are known for. And they are now known for their sending. They prayed for 10,000 missionaries to be sent by the year 2000, and by the year 2010, 20,000 missionaries had been sent. And they go to the difficult places. You may remember from 2007, there were the 27 Korean missionaries kidnapped by the Taliban, and a couple of them died. The reports are that, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the couple of Chinese that were killed in Pakistan, that they were working with a Korean businessman who had established a school and was using that to share the gospel. And there was a editorial in the Chinese mouthpiece that all these young Chinese were being led astray by the Korean missionaries. So they very much are a sending country in the world of missions. Okay. One thing that the Korean church is known for is it's dominated by mega churches, and with that comes its the good and the bad, but there have been numerous scandals with that in recent years, as mega churches and financial issues or things like that. South Korea too, I think the whole industrialized world tends to battle with, Western world tends to battle with materialism. Korea is no different from that. Maybe it's even a little bit harder to deal with because of the riches that the country has experienced within a relatively short period of time. And this is just shocking. I think South Korea has the highest rate of plastic surgery in the world. One out of every five women undergoes plastic surgery. So it's just, yeah, or earlier. I was reading up a little bit on this, and there was, now Amy didn't think it was quite as extreme as I did, but apparently there was a Miss Korea competition from 2013, and so they had a bunch of pictures, and there had been a big thing that went viral as to how much they all looked identical to each other in these pictures. And it was pretty obvious, but That was from the uniformity that comes from the high rate of plastic surgery. And they can, and culturally, there can be very business and educational focus to the neglect of the spiritual. If you go to school, if you're a student seeking to go to college, you're not only going to your classes all day long, but then your parents are having private tutors pretty much all evening. So with that, there can be very much a neglect of the spiritual that can come. And even though there has been this explosion of missionaries, it has been slowing within the last few years. And one issue that comes up that's been very interesting is just from the little bit that I've seen, being in China and reading about in other places, that the missionary movement in Korea was very much emphasized building up those elders, building up the locals to lead and support the church. But sometimes the Koreans themselves, as they go forth in the missions, they can't seem to, and I'm painting a broad brush here, but they tend to be controlling of the work that goes on in these countries. So that I knew of churches that were led by Korean missionaries in China, and they pretty much felt that they always needed to have a Korean as the pastor of the church. And that was appalling to me. You know, so many believers in China, and that these churches would feel that they didn't have proper leadership unless it was Korean leadership. And that I've heard stories too about that, as far as the Filipino church, that some of the there was recently some tensions that resulted there, as far as a businessman had been killed in the Philippines. He was a missionary, and it was creating some tension between both Korea and the Philippines and the churches, just some of the control that was still emphasized there. I think we see from that passage, and then how Paul goes on in Titus and other places, and the desire is to build up the body and then to allow them to go forth and to continue on the work. If everyone is expendable, and we should deem ourselves to be. And if we think that it can't survive without us, that's usually an issue with our heart first, and not with the people that we are with. Okay, the current focus of Korean missionary movement is that there's thought that there may be as many as 2,000 Korean missionaries in China at the moment. And then this one is a huge point of focus, and I think this is just so powerful. It's that the South Koreans really have a heart for their brothers and sisters in North Korea. And so much so that there's basically a network so that North Koreans who flee across the border into China, there is a network to bring those Koreans into South Korea and to share the gospel with them. And you can't just cross the border over into North Korea, into China from North Korea, cross the river, and then just take a boat to South Korea. They pretty much have to work all the way down to the very south of the country, cross over into Thailand, get arrested in Thailand, then seek asylum with South Korea, and then get taken up to South Korea. So it's quite a process. And if they get caught in China, they get sent back to North Korea to face pretty much certain death and to go to concentration camps. So the stakes are high, but it's been a powerful work of the Korean church to do so. The Korean church has this vision of having believers and reaching out into North Korea for their hope of one day the reunification of their country. And so South Koreans are working in Burma and Malaysia, Vietnam, Philippines, almost all of Asia. They oftentimes combine business and missions. And we talked a little bit about these other aspects of it. Okay, so there's the end of my... So...
We have identity cards, like we're talking about, like in Egypt and in China and stuff, where you're identified in their groups in the country.
Yeah, I don't know if they have that same sort of card, but they're very easy to be. My understanding it's very easy to catch them, obviously, because they're speaking Korean, or if they're speaking Chinese, they speak it very heavily accented. And there is a huge, the Chinese government really tries to infiltrate churches close to the North Korean border because there are so many Koreans that are passing through, and they are trying to catch them. And so it really is a challenge. But yeah, I read a book, and if you've got a pen or something, I would highly recommend. I'll write it here.
Can't do that.
Yeah. Okay. Let me find it. If you want to read a book a little bit about this, it was a book called These Are the Generations. And it's a short book. It was only about 100 pages. Oh. If you have Kindle, I was able to get it to read it on for free. Just check it out of Kindle. But it's a book of a family of three generations of Korean believers. North Korean believers, because and the thing that made this family so interesting is the guy who was writing the introduction was saying, well, oftentimes the Koreans who come to South Korea who are believers, they became believers on their trip because there are so many South Koreans who are ministering to them and assisting them in their travels that they become believers. But these were actually faithful believers for three generations, and it's just a amazing book. The one guy was he went to jail for a year, and the reason he went to jail for a year was that he was asked by one of his colleagues why his marriage was successful, and he said, I base my marriage upon the Ten Commandments, and he started listing those principles, and he spent a year in jail. And they actually released him, which they said, that's unheard of. I mean, they released him with no charges, and he was able to return. Just by saying that, for most people, would have resulted in their death. So just a powerful story. So I would, if you get a chance, it's a quick read. It was free on Kindle, so that was an interesting story to read. So I go back to... Oh well, here. So why the growth of the church in Korea? Factors, and I say potential factors. I say prayer. Obviously, prayer is not a potential factor, right? It is the factor. But like I said at the beginning, Korea is often examined as why has it taken such root in Korea? And the heart of the prayer of the people has certainly been a cause of the growth of the gospel there. The missionary methods of the early missionaries to really train up godly leaders and believers within the country, and making so it wasn't reliant upon outside countries, is often viewed as a reason for why it's stayed strong. Weakness of the local religion at the time of entry. My understanding is the time when Christianity came in, there wasn't quite the strong local religious identity that exists or existed in Japan at the time. And so that was one factor that several have looked upon as for why it grew. And the courage of the church in the face of Japanese oppression. One thing that's real interesting is that it appears that the Korean church in the time leading up to the end of World War II as a whole did not compromise the gospel in the face of Japanese persecution. And so that when the Japanese left and were kicked out, the church had a great deal of goodwill built up, that it had never kneeled to the Japanese oppressors, and so it had a great deal of credibility, and that assisted in the gospel. I heard that contrarily, other countries in that area, the church was known to compromise and to bow the knee to the Japanese, and they've never been fruitful in the meantime And so I think that we have that principle throughout Scripture, you know, looking at Romans 13 and other places of how we are to respond to the government and to obey the government, but we are not to bow the knee when those when what they seek violates Scripture and the principles that we have. And so these are some of the reasons why, or factors that people attribute the growth of the church in Korea. Any questions? Anything to talk about or discuss?
Yeah, I kind of have two. One, so in Korea, the government is the biggest opposing force to Christianity, as opposed to like Philippines and other Asian areas where other religions are more kind of the where the tension is. Is that right?
The persecution now in North Korea. Yes, it would be primarily government imposed. I think there was. It's believed that pretty much the believers, if they exist, well, they do exist, but most of the believers in North Korea are to be found within the concentration camps. And I mean, have you heard about did anybody read about the Virginian student, the student from University of Virginia who ended up dying after his abuse within these camps? I mean, they sound absolutely appalling. I think he was in a coma for over a year before coming back and dying almost immediately.
Oh, he had another question. But I was going to say, it'd be interesting. I thought it was interesting when you were talking at home about, you mentioned how the North Korean government has warped Christianity, like taken those principles that people would have been familiar with and put them on themselves as the ruling family. I think that was really interesting, if you want to mention some of those ways.
Well, I mean, I think it's just very much sort of the cult of personality and the saving, you know, looking at Kim Il-sung and then his son and now his grandson as sort of the savior of their country. And
like the Trinity, right? I mean, they even attribute themselves in some ways that way.
Yeah, yeah. They very much have sort of taken those principles and gone forth and warped them to fit its own. Their own cult. But we tend to think, you know, communist, atheistic, and they're communist, but it is more, it is a religion. So.
So it's not just principles, it's concepts too that we know that are true actually in the Bible that they try to fit it into.
Right, right. And, you know, they'll have the pictures up, and I mean, they're basic, the pictures up of their leaders, and they'll be essentially ascribing worship to those pictures, and yeah.
So do the people somewhat see them as gods? Do they view them that way?
That's the overlying philosophy. Now, whether it's in their heart, whether they're just, you know, giving lip service while in their hearts, I don't know, but
that's what's being promoted.
That is what is being promoted. Between the Catholics and the Protestants,
okay.
Yes.
What would the rest of the people? The
Buddhist would be a bit, or as they go forward, the materialistic, okay. Irreligion that is growing and is more and more becoming a part of the industrialized world. That's a very much a part of it too.
Do they have? Just because Christianity is such a bigger presence, which is shocking to see that in an Asian country, do they have a cultural Christianity where maybe, you know, that materialistic K-pop life or whatever, some of they're professing Christianity somewhat or no? Because I feel like my pictures, I see everybody going to those stadiums, those mega churches or whatever, but do you know if there's some kind of, the way it is in the South, I guess, some kind of cultural identity of Christianity?
I would assume so. I mean, we saw that in China,
okay.
You know. I think that's a threat almost anywhere. Well, no cultural Christians in North Korea, I would assume, but other places, you know, certain parts of China where there were large percentages of Christians. We noticed that Wenjo, I mean, very much considered a heart of the Chinese church. And so there were several students that we knew that identified as Christians because their parents were, their grandparents were, and we would talk to them, and it's like, eh, they really don't seem to have it. And we didn't think that we would see that when we went over there. But so I would assume that, yes, it's a danger, particularly there, because there is freedom of religion. It is enough of a cultural, there's enough cultural weight behind it with that many people that I'm sure it is probably an issue. And I think that's a danger of mega churches too, right? As far as you just go and are a part of a mega church, and there's may not be the accountability of being with a body that's smaller, and there's you have accountability with others. So that is a danger.
And yet we also did that when we were there. We were only there for 24 hours. But, I mean, we saw people doing street evangelism, people handing out, I mean, the local church doing their things, and they really were targeting us as tourists, you know. And there was a quote that Matt read in that book that just, you know, we often pray for the North Korean believers, and the quote was something like, "You're praying for us, we're praying for you," mm-hmm. you know, just because of all the temptations that our churches face in a materialistic world.
Yeah. Yeah, their quote was, "We only have Jesus, you have so many other things, we pray for you." It's just like, wow, wow. It's humbling.
Along the lines of my other question, is there a sending nation in many ways? You're talking about them being paternalistic as they're kind of engaging these other cultures. And I think particularly in America, do you see from the missions perspective problems with ethnic churches in general? So I know, like, in the Northeast, they have Korean churches where Korean believers go there. And so I'm just thinking from a missions perspective on the whole, is that detrimental to the church body? To segregate out into ethnic groups, particularly in America, I think you see that.
I guess it. That's an interesting question. I think if they stay insular in that way, but I think there can be some great advantage in that too, of they can then pursue those, have a heart for particular missions. I mean, just that they can then have the heart for going back and supporting and going into North Korea.
And worshiping in their own language.
Yeah.
That's the primary thing. Because I don't remember which group it was, but I've heard that same thing. It talked about, I think it was even Harvard had sent missionaries a long time ago to these other nations, and all of a sudden those students coming back to Harvard from those nations are actually evangelizing on the campus in America that had originally sent to them.
Yeah.
And so the Koreans, I'm thinking a similar thing, as they come back to America, if they all congregate in tight churches and they're not spreading out into all these churches where it is culturally Christian and stuff, that they can impact them with actually like Ron was preaching about this morning. Yeah. Life truly lives for Christ.
Well, interestingly enough, while it's 25-30% of those in Korea identify as Christians, the church, I think it's something like 71% of Koreans in the U.S. identify as Christians. So yes, it's very much it's very much an aspect of the culture. I think we've seen that too with. China is very much the same way with the strength of Chinese churches in the country, but I think those have been used too. I mean, there are Chinese communities everywhere, and so the Chinese church has really allowed, in other countries, hasn't really been used to go into China, but then to all these other countries where Chinese are located. I think it's probably more a matter of the heart and the heartbeat of the church itself as to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.